and then we'll continue with this next week in Yitzhak Hashem. All right. So he says, the Chaverim, the scholars, they asked Rav Kana, what about this Omer that the people of Israel sacrificed after they entered Eretz Yisrael? Meheichon hikrivuhu. Where did they get the barley that they used for the sacrifice of the Omer? Im tomar, if you say the ayil biyad nachri, that this was actually grain that was grown in Eretz Yisrael by whom? By the goyim, right, who lived in Canaan, right? So, how could you bring the Omer from such grain when it's written Ketzir Chem? It has to be your harvesting. In other words, it has to be harvested by the Jews, right? And of course, actually, it was harvested by the Kohanim, as we learn in other places. Ketzir Chem Omer Rachmon, velo Ketzir Nochri, and not what a goy had harvested. Okay, so they say, Mimai de Yagrifu. How do we know that they did sacrifice? Maybe Dilma Laikriu, maybe they didn't bring an Omer that year. So he says, Loisalkodatek. No, you can't argue that. Dixiv, it says written, it's written specifically, Vayochlu mi avuhu ors from Lachas HaPesach, right? That they ate of the produce of the land the morning after Pesach, okay? So if it's written in Lachas HaPesach Ochu, that when did they begin eating the produce of the land, it was the day after Pesach. May Yikor Eloi Ochum. So obviously, they didn't eat anything prior to that of the food of Eretz Yisrael, right? The Yikrivu Omer. Because first they had to do what? They had to be marked with the Omer. They had to bring the Korban of the Omer. Rahodo Achle, right? And then after that, they ate. So, Mehechon Yikrivu. So in that case, let's get back to the original question. So where did they get it from that, you know, that they were able to bring a korban? Yeah. So on the other hand, so what did Rav Kana say to them? He said unto them, Kol shelo hevi shalish biyat nochri, right? This is produce which had not yet attained a third of its growth, even though it was planted by whom? By the goy. So if it didn't, then of course, then in that case, we have to say that, that what? We have to say that in that particular case, since it had not yet attained a third of its growth, therefore it still was not subject to being brought to the Omer, right? And therefore, by this time, prior to this, the Jew now owned the land, right? And therefore was Jewish growth. So even though it was not planted by the Goy, even though it was planted by the Goy, but it was not yet ready, eligible to be bought for the Omer, it was now eligible to be bought for the Omer because it had attained, by the time of the third of the growth, it was now already in Jewish hands. All right, we'll stop at this point because we're not finished yet with the senior. All right, so we see that actually, of course, it ties in general with the major problem which started off this discussion, which is at what particular point does something attain its growth so that it should be subject to Meiser, right? And to which year should we assign the Meiser? You see, that's what started the whole deal. So if we say, of course, that the people of Israel started, to bring the Omer after they reached Eretz Yisrael, I guess it's working, I don't know, it's a little... It fell down in the car, but it was in the case, so I was hoping that it wasn't injured or something. Yes. Yeah, in the middle over there, you see where it's written, Vayochlu me'avuhos v'mochas ha'pesach, right? That they began eating of the tevua, of the produce of the land, the day after Pesach. So from this we say that the day after they began eating, why did they begin eating from it the day after Pesach? Yeah, b'macharat ha'pesach, right. So the answer is that because they wouldn't eat prior to what? Prior to the bringing of the Korban Omer, okay? The Omer has to be brought on the second day of Pesach, and once it is brought in the Beis HaMikdosh, or in those days, let's say, in the tabernacle, whatever they had in those days, then in that particular time, from that point on, the new produce was available. But the objection that they raised is, that when is Pesach? Pesach is the 14th, the 15th, right? Begins the 14th at night. In other words, it's the 15th of Nisan, right? The day after Pesach is the 16th of Nisan. This is the day that they began eating the new produce, correct? But if we read earlier in Sefer Yehoshua, we see that when did they actually cross into Eretz Israel? When did they cross the Jordan and begin to, take the earliest possession possible of Eretz Israel? Obviously, they didn't possess the whole land, but the area that they had on the other side, on the Eretz Israel side of the Jordan, right? They had already occupied because they crossed the Jordan. So, in that case, where did they get the produce from which they could make the Omer, and from which subsequently they were able to eat? It had to have been planted by whom? By the Goy, by the people who lived in Eretz Yisrael prior to that, the Canaanites. Correct? So the question is, how could they bring a Korban Omer from something that was planted by Goyim? Because the Torah says, Mereshis Ketzir Chem, right? Havesem is Omer Reshis Ketzir Chem El HaKohen, is what's written over there. Okay? You ought to bring the Omer, the very first thing that you reap, right, to the Kohen, right? And then he creates the Omer, and then he has to make the sacrifice of the Omer, and so on. Tnei Hashem Mochas HaPesach, that's the way it's written over there, in the Torah. So that, if that's the case, we have to apply a principle that is stated over here, namely, that if the plant has not yet attained a third of its growth prior to the event, right, then in that particular case, it is possible to consider the plant as being Jewish because it attained the third of its growth. In other words, to make it eligible to make a Korban Omer out of it when it was now in Jewish possession. So this is the Drei, okay? Irv is not happy with the Drei, but this is what the Gemara says over here, okay? So this is how they explain it. All right, so we continue. So the Gemara now asks the following question. It says, Viduma Ayel Velekim Lehu, right? Maybe it did produce already a third of the grain under who? Under the Goy, you understand? But the Lokim Lehu would mean that, but the Jews, the rabbis, the sages, whoever they had, right, the Nevi'im, that they weren't aware of that. They weren't expert in this. This is what the implication is. So the Gemara answers, Elokim Lehu. So we have to assume that they were expert enough to know the difference whether a plant had already attained a third of its growth or not. Okay, so far so good. So Okaname, we have to say that inasmuch as they are experts, so here too in the case of the Korban, they knew the difference, right? And not only that, but we could also say that maybe if we apply it to the case that started off the whole discussion, namely, how do we assign a plant on the basis of what year the Maaser should be given from it, right? And we said that if it had attained a third of its growth prior to Rosh Hashanah, this is what started the whole deal, right? If it attained a third of its growth prior to Rosh Hashanah, then we said, Misatzer, in other words, the Maaser is going to be assigned to the previous year, but if it did not attain a third of its growth by Rosh Hashanah, then in that case, once it attains it, obviously it's already now part of the new year that began with Rosh Hashanah, and therefore it has to be tithed according to that. Remember, this goes back again to what we had last week and 2 weeks ago and so on, namely the whole cycle of time, that in years 1 and 2, he gave Maaser Rishon to Maaser Sheni. In year 3 of the cycle, you give Maaser Rishon and you give Maaser Ani. And then you do the same, 4 and 5 follow like 1 and 2, and then 6 is like year 3. And then, of course, the Shvius, you don't give Maasers. Okay. So, this is what the conclusion is. This is what was started the whole deal. So, going back to the general question, we have to say then that maybe they did know the difference between whether it has attained a third or not. This is what the Gemara has asked. With Dilma Layal Klal, maybe it had not yet attained that third. Avol Hecho de Ayel, Riva Ben Shlish, the Poches Ben Shlish, Lekim Lehu. Where they're saying, but okay, maybe if it had attained already, maybe a fourth. So in that case, you don't know whether it's a third of its growth already that has been attained, or less than a third, right? Lekim Lehu. So that they would say that they were not expert. This is the question that is being asked. So the Gemara says, No, he says, don't even begin thinking about that. You have to bear in mind that, first of all, they were already expert in the growing of things, so that they knew how to recognize the age, let's say, of a plant when it was harvested, right? And secondly, getting back to this whole business about the story that we read, you know, about the bringing of the Omer in the book of Joshua, we have to re-examine that again. Alright, you want to pass this down? So the Gemara says, Lo Salko Da'atech, right? Don't believe that. We have to assume that they did know what's going on. Why? Dixiv, getting back again to the book of Yoshua, what do we find written over there? The Ho'om Olumen Hayardim Be'osalah Chodesh, right? This is what I had cited before, that the people of Israel arose, that is, they got up from crossing the Jordan River on the 10th day of the month, which of course is the month of Nisan. Now, the Esau Kedatech Delo Ayel Klal, right? And if you are of the opinion that this grain could not ripen, right? Bechamisha, yeah, that it could not ripen sufficiently. So he says, Bechamisha Yome Mikomalya. He was saying that 5 days, in other words, between the 10th and what? The 15th of Nisan. Are you implying then that it can't ripen? Maybe it could ripen. How do we know that? Elamai de Ayel, Riva, Odanka, Akati Bechamisha Yomim Mikom Alya. So, you mean to tell me, says the Gemara, that it actually could ripen a fourth or even a lesser amount? The Odanka is a very tiny amount, okay? Even in 5 days, you mean to say it can't happen? Elamai is the Cholam Hamar. So how can you explain the fact that all of a sudden we have a grain, you know, that is ripe enough in order to bring the Omer from it? So it comes back with a very interesting theory. It says, Eretz Tzvi Kisiv Bo, right? Which means that the land of Israel is called, happens to be a quotation, the book of Daniel, and it's called Eretz Tzvi. Now, what do we mean by Eretz Tzvi? So, we have to say as follows. Okay, first of all, the word Tzvi in Aramaic, it does not mean a deer. Okay? What does Tzvi in Aramaic? Tzvi is the verb which means to desire something. Okay? In other words, it's something like the word Ratzah in Hebrew as far as the meaning of the word is concerned. Okay? to want something, to desire something, this is Tzvi. So that, in other words, what is really the meaning of Eretz Tzvi? This is the land which the Rebbeinu Shel Olam desires to be what? Should be the land of, the people of Israel, correct? So that's one of the names given to Eretz Israel. It's called Eretz Tzvi. However, we also know that in the Hebrew, the word Tzvi means a deer, right? So what is the connection between the idea of a land which is like a deer? By the way, there are other meanings too given to it. But over here, this is what he explains. So he says, inasmuch as it's written in the Bible, Eretz Tzvi, so Hachinami, so here again, in connection with the story of when did it become ripe enough, so Eretz Tzvi, Kasibo. We have to say that this applies also to this particular case. Now, how does he explain it? So, Rashi gives the following explanation. Okay. Eretz Tzvi, this is about five lines before it widens out over there, says, Matzvi kal baraglov mikol achayos. He says, just as the deer is the swiftest of the animals, so Eretz Yisrael kala levasha perusecha mikol harotzes. So likewise, Eretz Yisrael is swifter to have ripe fruits, that is, swifter to ripen its fruits than all other lands. And he says, Hachim Mefarish Lov B'Sach HaKsubas B'Perek Basman. This is the explanation given in Masechus Ksubas in the last chapter of it, where the last chapter of Ksubas, they make mention about Eretz Yisrael, and they have some very interesting halachas and agodas and so on in that connection. Now, I do want to say that there is another explanation given for Eretz Tzvi. Very interesting one, that's why I'm quoting it over here, even though it's not in the Rashi. Okay. Eretz Tzvi, according to one interpretation, why do they compare it to a deer? They say, if you would take a deer, flay the skin of it, right? You wonder how it could ever hold all the things, and you try to reconstruct it, put it together again. You wonder how it ever could be able to hold all the contents. So it says, likewise, Eretz Yisrael, the land seems to stretch, and no matter how many people are there, but there's always room for more Eden in Eretz Yisrael. There's always room. We call to mind the fact that, for example, what did the British try to do to the Jews? They tried to prevent them from going into Eretz Yisrael. And what basis did they use for it? They had royal commissions, if you remember. And what did the royal commissions find? There's no room, right? No room for the Yidden in Eretz Yisrael. Whatever. So, there's no room in Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Tzvi proves that there is room for more and more and more in Eretz Yisrael, and we hope and we pray that more and more Eden will come and settle in Eretz Yisrael.
Does that mean that today's day and age that the crop is going to grow as fast as they say here, as it did then, will do it so now, no matter who owns it, Goy or Yid?
Well, that already is a good question that you're asking me, and I don't have a ready answer for it. My answer would be based upon what we find in Sefer Yechezkel. Yechezkel describes how Eretz Yisrael, after the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, the first Beis Hamikdash, right, and the Babylonian exile, Jews were exiled from the land. The land became shmama, right? In other words, it became like a wilderness. Nothing there, desolation, okay? The Goyim didn't do anything in order to make it a better land. To him, the sign of the coming redemption is the fact that when Jews will return, the land itself will begin to once more bring forth its fruits and its plants and everything else for the benefit of the people of Israel. In our own day, we know that the same thing happened. Eretz Yisrael, as described, let's say, 100 years ago by Mark Twain. He wrote a book called Innocence Abroad, in which he has a description of a trip to various lands taken by American citizens, and included in Eretz Yisrael. And the land was absolutely waste. You had, you know, a few Arabs here and there, a few Jews, and so on and so on, but nothing at all. And he was convinced, I mean, that Eretz Yisrael would never amount to anything. What do we see? We see what the Jews have done to Eretz Yisrael. So that it is possible that in certain ways, Eretz Yisrael Taket, even today, begins to have its fruits ripen even earlier than in many other lands. I know one thing, and that is that when you have a fresh piece of fruit which has been grown in Eretz Yisrael, it has a charm that cannot be compared to what you buy in the supermarkets over here, whether it's strawberries or peaches or whatever it may be. It has such a charm that you can't duplicate. So obviously when it does ripen, it ripens quickly. The area around Kinneret was famous for the fact that fruits ripen very quickly over there. Of course, one of the explanations is the very fact, I mean, that the Kinneret area is already below sea level, so that you have much more warmth over there, and because you have more warmth, it means that you can have much faster ripening of fruits over there. So we shouldn't look down upon these agoras about Eretz Yisrael, because they contain a great deal of thought and observation in them. Alright, so what is he saying over here? So what he's saying over here is what? Saying over here that, okay, because Eretz Yisrael has that ability for its fruits, products to ripen more quickly, then it was possible that even when the people of Israel crossed the Jordan and the fruits the barley had not yet attained a third of its growth on the 10th day of the month of Nisan, yet within 5 days it had attained it sufficiently to the point that they're able to bring the Omer carbon, from it, and to make it possible from that point on that the people of Israel were able to eat the new produce of the land. Okay. So now, so far so good, right? So, but nevertheless, we find now Matzkif lo Rabbi Chanina, right? Rabbi Chanina questions this. He says to me, Motzis, is it possible, he says, Amrit, that you could say the High Osif Kotzehu, that the word Asif means harvest? The Hoksiv, isn't it written, be Ospecha, when you gather Migorn Chomi Yikvecha, from your threshing floor and from your vat, where you press the olives and the grapes? The Yom Amar, and they gave a different interpretation as to what it means. I mean, according to the, if we read the Pshat of the Torah, there's no question. What does the Pshat mean? It says, Chags HaSukkos Taseh L'cho Shavas Yomim, right? You are to celebrate Sukkos for 7 days. The Ospecho Megoron Chum Nigvecha, the time, when you gather all these things from your threshing floor and from your vats, okay? In other words, when is Sukkot to be celebrated? It's to be celebrated at the time of the harvest. Okay? That's what it means. That's Pshat. But the question is, so why does it say, again, that the Chag HaSif Taseh L'cho, in another Pasuk, in other words, you are to celebrate the festival of the ingathering, which of course is a reference to Sukkot. In other words, why do we need, more than one pasuk in order to teach us this lesson? So that therefore they come up with a different idea as to what does it mean, the Yom HaBar, and one of the sages said that this means Bipsoilas Goyrin, the Yekiv HaKosim Adavir, that the Torah is talking about what is left behind. In other words, the Psoilas, you know, is anything that already has lost all its value because it's no longer what it should be. The best part was already gathered, and the Psoilas, this is the refuse, so to speak, whatever was left behind, okay? So Rashi explains as follows. I don't know if you see the second long line in the Rashi. The second long line on the page in the Rashi, the Yom HaMar, you see that?
Yeah.
It says, the Yom HaMar, and it says, and one of the sages said, Shalimetcha Kosov, that the meaning of the Pasuk over here is to teach you something else. It's La'asosachach Shalsuka Bifsoilas Goyim V'yekev. He says, you are to use for the schach of your sukkah, the refuse, what's left over from the threshing floor and from the that, namely kigon, as for example he says kashin, which means straw, uzmoros, or branches, right? And what is their characteristic? The characteristic is dovor shein mekabel tumo. First of all, these things cannot be susceptible to tumo, right? And secondly, the gidulo min ha'aretz, and it has to be the kind of a material that grows from the ground. Okay? These are the two characteristics of the schach that we have to use. It has to be taka, something that grows from the ground, right? And of course, if it means grown from the ground, but at the same time we have to add, and it's also, it's no longer attached to the ground. For example, you can't use a grapevine that's still there, you understand? If you wanted to use that, what do you have to do? You have to cut it off so it's no longer attached to the ground, right? And at the same time, it has to be something that cannot be susceptible to tumor. In other words, you cannot use something that can be. As for example, you can't use for schach, let's say, a wooden implement, a wooden pot or a pan or something like that. You can't use it, okay? Because a pot or a pan is susceptible, right, to being tummy and so on. So you can't use that, okay? It has to be simply pshutayetz, as we would say. In other words, plain wood or something like that. So that's why with the bamboo, you know, you have to ask a question. Plain bamboo, where one rod is cut off from the other, there's no question that it's permissible. Question is only now about, you know, these bamboo mats, whether they're kosher or not. Well, the average person is willing to say that they are, because they say that the bamboo mat is not susceptible to tumor, okay? But that you'll find, yeah.
It doesn't collect anything, is that the protection?
Yeah, it's not a kli, it's not like a vessel. A vessel can be susceptible to it, but it's a non-vessel. And so therefore, they say it's only an ordinary piece of wood, that's all that it is, so that therefore they say on that basis it's kosher, okay? And look, we don't try to create all kinds of chumras, you know, that they're going to be terrible for people. We want to encourage people to do it. So if you have, a lenient opinion from a great Gaonim, you know, so in that case he uses it, that's all. But as Rashi says, you know, these are the two characteristics of schach, and he bases it on this pasuk, right? It's a dovah shein mekabel tumor, right? The gedulim and horas. Now it says to the high chag osif, and how about the pasuk which speaks about chag osif? So it's not be the command is seroi. It says, as we already said, it's an additional pasuk mishum dechsev, because it's written gabe bi ospechos maasecho. Love you, say Rahu. All right, that in connection where it says that you gather in your things, this is not something extra. Elazehu Shema Chag, but rather this implies what? That the holiday is called what? course, the Torah calls it as Chag HaSukkot, but it also refers to it as what? Chag HaAsif. So in other words, that's it. That's how we learn that it's one of the titles given to Sukkot, and we identify the harvest festival with what? With the Sukkot festival. That's it. In other words, we can't say that the harvest festival should be a month after Sukkot. You understand? Because maybe at that time you finally finished gathering everything you had before, right? But we interpret, you know, why is it called Chag HaAsif? Because this is the time of the year when people are usually gathering in their produce, and this is the proper time to celebrate Sukkot. But of course the Torah gave us a date for Sukkot too. Specifically, what did it say? It has to be on the 15th day of the 7th month. So we know that we identify one with the other. Alright, so Omar Rab Zera, getting back to the Gemara. So Rab Zera said, Ha milsoda havai biyoda, says, you know, we had this explanation, we figured it out. V'yosa Rabbi Chanina shoda be'nargo, and along came Rabbi Chanina and he threw a hatchet into it. In other words, all of a sudden, we thought we had the answer pat, and now all of a sudden, we have a problem again. So if that's the case, Elamin Alon. So how do we know about the fact, you know, that let's say that produce should be at least a third of its growth before it can be considered as being eligible for you know, for Miser, right? For the tithing. So the answer is, we have it in a different pasuk. Pasuk says as follows: Kedetani Rabbi Yonasan ben Yosef, as Rabbi Yonasan ben Yosef interpreted the pasuk, says the pasuk says as follows. Sorry, man. The also says Hatvua l'shlosh hashonim. So, we have to first of all again identify where exactly does this pasuk come from. This pasuk comes from the Torah, in reference, of course, to Shavuos, okay? We know that the Rebbeinu Shel Olam said what? When it comes to the seventh year, you're not to do any, right? Be'horish, Ba'kotzir, you're not allowed to do any kind of agricultural work, okay? So the question is, V'chi somru, Torah says, all right, and what if you say, Ma nochal, Bashanoa Hashminis, what will we eat in the eighth year? Alright, assuming in the seventh year we have certain things that we can eat, right? Because we said the land is Hefker, and therefore each person can take what he needs, okay. But if you don't do any agricultural work during the seventh year, then how are we going to have food in the eighth year, right? Huh? So right, so therefore the Torah says that in the sixth year the Rebbeinu Shel Olam will give so much plenty in the field, right, that the also satvua l'shalosh hashanim, it will provide enough grain, enough of a harvest for 3 years to come. Okay? For 3 years to come. All right. So the Gemara now says on the next page, he says, Al Tikra Lishalosh. He says, don't interpret now the Pasuk in the way that we have just interpreted, but let's use the Pasuk for a different lesson. You know, because Psukim can be applied to this idea, it can also be applied to other ideas as well, correct? So, what does he say? He says, let's apply the word l'shalosh, right, for three, ela l'shalish. Let's apply it, right, to one third. In other words, when does a crop become mature enough so that it can be counted for miser in a particular year? The answer is when it has attained shalish, one third of its growth, right? The homi boy leila gufei. And we needed to go right back again to the whole business about Shavuos. Ksiv Krachrino. We have another pasuk which says, uzratem, and you shall plant your seeds, es hashana hashminis, right? Planted during the eighth year, va'achaltem in hatvua yoshon, and you are to eat during that year, it's understood, old grain that has already been harvested previously, from previous years, ad hashana hatshiyis, until the ninth year. And then whatever you plant in the eighth year will now be available when? In the ninth year. So that accounts for the 3 years. So that being the case, we think that we have now a hard and a fast rule, right? About one third of its growth automatically means that it's ripe enough, it's mature enough to be counted one way or another, correct? But now we see that it's not so blunt, because first of all, we had some time ago, a couple of weeks ago, in reference to trees. What do we say about trees? We said at that time that if the tree had taken root 30 days prior to Rosh Hashanah, then in that case, we considered it as being part, let's say, of the sixth year, and it's not subject to Shvi'is in the seventh year, okay? But if it was, you know, less than 30 days to Rosh Hashanah, then in that particular case, what did we say? We say that this already could not have taken root, and therefore, when did it first take root? In the seventh year, and therefore that tree now becomes subject to the law of Shvi'is. Okay? So, this is one thing that we had. Now they're going to talk about other types of plants. Okay? Yeah. And we also said that in connection with urokos, vegetables, there was an opinion that we had before that said it's achala kitoso. What is achala kitoso? After you actually gather it in, that's when it becomes subject to miser. And at that time we learned there's a difference as to whether it's the kind of vegetables that have to be bundled together, right? In which case it first happens when you actually bundle them together, or if they're not bundled together, then at the time that you fill a basket with the loose ones. At that point, when you have enough to do it, this is when it becomes subject to miser. So that takes care of what? Of your rockers. But we have other types of vegetables, and this is now what they're going to talk about. This is what we call the kitnios. What are kitnios? Kitnios are in general beans, peas, that kind of thing. Okay? That's in general what they are. As you know, they're not chometz, but nevertheless, we Ashkenazic Jews refrain from eating them during Pesach. Why? Who knows? This goes back already to a time when they thought that maybe it would either become chometz stick, or it was mixed in with flour, which might render it chometz stick, whatever it is. So we have the custom not to. But we also know that, for example, in among the Sephardim, they never accepted this chumrah of kitnios, and so as a normal rule, they eat kitnios. I still remember how shocked I was to go into a kosher grocery on Pesach, and there's Israel, and see rice cakes over there. But the answer is, the rice cakes are not for us. The rice cakes are for whom? For the Sephardim. They are permitted to eat them, okay? The same thing with rice in general, with corn, things like that, that they are permitted to eat during Pesach, we can. So that falls into a general category that we call kitnios. Yes?
Sorry to get you off the track, but
yeah.
Could you just, another part about the tree.
Yeah.
Shemashvili.
Right.
What was the significance of it being in the 7 years opposed to the 6 years?
Okay, the significance, of course, there actually is not so much with the Shvius idea. There, with the trees, the basic problem was, you know, the whole problem of Orlov and Revai. Right. Where we know that the first 3 years of a tree, so you're not allowed to eat the fruit of it, period. The fourth year, in days when the Beis HaMikdash was in existence, so, you know, they would gather the fruit and then bring it to Yerushalayim. And this is what we call, the Revai or the Maser Master Shady, they would bring and so on and so forth. Okay, the fifth year they were probably, you know, at that point, then the three could be eaten without any question, whatever. Okay, so if the tree had already taken root prior to Rosh Hashanah, then we learned that when Rosh Hashanah came, that automatically meant the end of the first year of the existence, right? Whereas if it had not taken root prior to Rosh Hashanah, then in that particular case, the first year would be the one that begins with that Rosh Hashanah. So this is really where it made the difference. Not so much Shvius, really, as as far as the tree is concerned. Okay, yeah. All right. All right, so now we have a listing of certain kidneys, okay? Tanan Hossam, we have a Mishnah where we learned as follows. It says, Ha'orez v'ha'docham v'ha'progim ha'shumshimim. Okay, orez, everybody agrees practically, that this means rice. Certainly this is the meaning of it today, okay? Everybody refers to rice in Hebrew as orez, okay? And if you want to say rice cakes, they're called priche, orez, okay? All right, and what is dochen? Dochen, that usually translated as millet or something. It is not exactly a grain. It is a grain, but not a grain. I mean, it's not a grain in the sense like wheat or barley, or, you know, but it is a kind of a grain, millet, okay? The haprogim, these are poppies, meaning, you know, like the poppy seeds that we have, the mon and so on, okay? So it's also a type of kidneys. The hashimshimin, of course, this is the word that we recognize as, you know, sesames, right? Shehish rishu, if they took root lifnei Rosh Hashanah, before Rosh Hashanah, then what? Then misasrin l'sheavar. Then the miser consideration is from the previous year. Okay? In other words, if, let's say, they took root prior to Rosh Hashanah, then in that case we would say that the Maaser of that particular year is what determines what it is. Is it the Maaser of Rishon?
How can you determine what it was from root?
The answer is only that you take a look at the growth afterwards to see. You understand? If it looks mature enough once you harvest it, then what can you say?
But
then on the basis of that, then you say that obviously it must have taken root prior to Rosh Hashanah. Right. There's no question. I mean, that as we saw on the previous side of the page, that, you know, he questions, you know, Kim lehu l'rabbanan, are the rabbis that expert that they can tell the difference between one and another? But, so we said, yeah, Kim lehu. They are expert enough to know what to do. That goes back to another question that we had last week, if you remember, where, again, we had rabbi was Rabbi Yirmido, if I remember correctly, who questions about the whole business about Shiurim, right? And he was told, the rabbis set the standards, and you don't question it, you know, that this is what it is. And, you know, he gave the example, of the mikveh, right? That if you have 40 se'or in the mikveh, then it's a kosher mikveh. If it's lacking even a tiny amount from the 40, then in that case, the mikveh is invalid. You can tevel in it, and you have not teveled, you understand? Because there isn't enough water in there. So it's the rabbis who made that determination, right? And the same thing, you know, with the questions of Tumah and Tara, you know, to what extent, and so on. So the rabbis have to set the standards, and we have to assume that when they set the standards, that they know the difference. When they say about that it's a kibetza, right, the size of an egg, or it is kezias, like the size of an olive, even to us, if we are not that expert, that we can tell the difference between the size of a beitza and the size of an olive, but nevertheless, they had definite standards in mind. So we have to say that they had this expertise to know the difference. But obviously, it had to be after they already began gathering it in that they could tell from the on the basis of its maturity as to when it had taken root, whether it was prior to Rosh Hashanah or whether it was after Rosh Hashanah. All right, so about these things, all right, that they took root before Rosh Hashanah, so it says, Misasvan and Sheovar, then in that particular case, we say that the Miser that has to be given is from the previous year, Umotar and Bishvius, and therefore we're also allowed to eat these things in Shvius, not just to eat them, but presumably even to sell them in Shvius, because they are not the products of Shvius. Instead, what are they the products of? They're the products of Shishis, of the 6th year, not the 7th year. You understand? Because they took root prior to Rosh Hashanah. Okay. V'yim lav, but if not, then what? Asurin b'shviz, then they are prohibited in the 7th year. Because, in other words, we assume then that these actually grew in the 7th year, that they took root in the 7th year, and therefore they are purely the product of the 7th year. And therefore, the miser that is given over there is for the following year and not for the year prior to Rosh Hashanah. Omar Rabba said, Omur Rabbanan. The rabbi said as follows. He said, Elon, a tree, Besar Chanota. You have to judge according to when, by the way, this is, as you can see, it's not quite the same rule.